A collection of everything. So big it can never be catalogued or appraised. The loot of the world.
You got 5 seconds to tell me where you buried the loot. Where's the loot?
I don't know who's got the loot. I don't know if anybody's got the loot.
Hello looters, welcome to Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. This is our third episode of 2021. I hope you're all doing great, and I hope you enjoyed our first episode with guest Leonard Rubart. Like I said on our previous episode, the first loot episode has become our most downloaded episode, and it did it within a day. So thank you all for listening. We also have a second episode, the January Loot, with no guest, just me talking about the films I saw in January, so feel free to check it out also. But anyway, for this episode, which we're calling the Comedy Loot, we have another great guest, Steve Mazin. Let's go!
The Comedy Loot.
Hello everybody, welcome to Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. I'm joined today by a great guest, stand-up comedian, author, and Emmy Award-winning writer, Steve Mazin. Steve, welcome. How are you doing?
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you here. Let's start talking a bit about yourself. How did you get into comedy?
Yeah, it's funny you ask that. It's a very timely question because I have a podcast as well, and it's all about movies, and movies kind of got me into stand-up comedy. So a specific movie when I was 12 years old, I got to see, we got cable, and it's not a big deal. You're from a younger generation, but it was a big deal when cable came around. You know, you only had 3 or 4 channels at that point. And so when we got cable, in fact, I was like, are we rich? To be like, all my friends had cable before us. So I was like, we got cable? So we had HBO. So the first night, you know, watched a couple movies with my mom, and then she went to bed and I pretended to go to sleep. And I came back out and Richard Pryor Live in Concert was showing. So I sat and watched it, and I was 11 years old, 10 or 11, and he was saying things a 10 or 11-year-old shouldn't be listening to, but it was the greatest thing in my life. And I had seen comedians before, like on late-night shows, but they were doing like 5 minutes, and they were all jokey-joke kind of things. But here was a guy just talking about his life, and he was being completely honest, talking about all the terrible things in his life, his family, his drug addiction, but making it hilarious. And it was the first time I realized, oh, you can make a living doing that? Like, so that was the first moment where I was like, I want to do that. I want to be in front of a crowd and get paid to do that. And then from there, then I started watching more comedians, and then I fell in love with David Letterman. Came out a couple years after that. He had been on other shows and hosting, you know, The Tonight Show. But then he got his own show after The Tonight Show, and I started staying up and watching that. And my mom didn't realize that she hated Letterman, so she wouldn't watch him. So it was like my thing. So that was kind of the impetus that I started seeing the comedians on there, and I knew David Letterman was a comedian. And I was like, when I grow up, I want to do that. So that was the impetus, but it took, you know, obviously I couldn't have started at 10 or 12 years old when those two things happen. But even still, let's say 18 or 21, when I could have got into the clubs and stuff, I didn't start then. It took a long time just to get the balls or the cojones to kind of get in there and do it. So I didn't start till I was 29. I was in San Francisco, and I'd heard that's a great comedy town. So I looked up open mics and went out to an open mic it ended up being at a laundromat. They had an open mic comedy show, and that was my first time up and fell in love with it. And yeah, I've been doing it ever since.
That's great. So you said your mom didn't like the show, so she really wasn't very happy with your decision?
No, I think, yeah. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, which is probably the most, conservative area of the United States. So yeah, there the idea was kind of like, no, you grow up, if you can go to college, you go to college, and then you get a steady job, and you work at that same job till you die. You know, that's the plan. So to suggest something crazy, you know, I live in California now, so everyone I know is somehow involved in the entertainment industry. But back in the Midwest, in Illinois, no one was. I remember later, probably around this time, maybe a couple of years after, like the Richard Pryor and the Letterman thing, I became friends with a kid at school, and his dad was a cameraman for the local TV station. And that was a big deal. That was the closest I knew to anyone actually being involved in entertainment. So yeah, my mom's attitude was like, no, 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 no. Like, You can dream about that, but you're not going to do that. You're going to do something stable. You're not going to really be that. So she kind of poo-pooed that idea.
So what did you do before Dad moved to San Francisco?
So, yeah, so when I got out of high school, went in the Navy for 5 years, and I served aboard a submarine. I lived aboard a sub for 4 of those 5 years, decided I never wanted to get on a ship that went underwater again, and so got out, went to college back in Illinois, and then once I finished college, it's kind of a funny story. My sister, who is older, I have an older brother and sister, but I still kind of have the only child syndrome a little bit. Both that the young child, there's a lot of comedians that are the youngest child because they're, you know, starved for attention, that kind of thing. But I also have a little, there was a gap between me and my older brother and sister. They're about 5 and 6 years older. So I think I was the mistake. Like my parents were
Same year.
Yeah, they thought they were done. And then I was the surprise. So like there's no pictures of me. They didn't put any work into my childhood. There's nothing like.
No. My older brother's picture album is like this thick. Yeah. Mine is like this.
Yeah, exactly. They're just like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Well, I've been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly. So my sister, though, at this time, when I finished college then, she was living in San Francisco, and she was starting a family. She had just had her second child. So she had 2 kids. 1 was 2 and 1 was 1. And I wanted to see them grow up. I wasn't planning on getting married or having kids anytime soon. So that's why I moved to San Francisco from Chicago. And I got there, and 6 months after I moved out there, picked up and moved my whole life out there, her husband got a job back in Chicago, and they moved back. So that then I was kind of left in San Francisco, which is a town I wouldn't have moved to probably on my own, you know, unless she was there. But I was left there, and I was like, do I move back to Chicago now? What do I do? But I had fallen in love with San Francisco. It's a fantastic city. And I had heard a lot of my being a lover of stand-up comedy, I knew that it was a great comedy city. I knew that Robin Williams had started there and Dana Carvey and Jake Johansson. And, you know, she's got a long list, history of comedy and a great club scene. So I decided, I was like, well, if I'm out here by myself, rather than chasing my family back to the Midwest, I should do this thing that I've wanted to do for, at that point, you know, 16, 17 years, I had been talking about doing it, but had never got the chutzpah to do it. So that was the impetus to finally, you know, go out to an open mic and do it.
A lot of comedians talk about how hard or rough is at first. Was it like that to you?
Yeah. But I think the good thing is, you know, ignorance is bliss. You don't know. I remember going, so again, that night at the laundromat, I got there. I had a day job at that time. I was actually finding jobs. It was the first dot-com boom kind of in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. So I had a job placing people in jobs. So it was a super easy job because everyone was hiring at that time. So I worked out in the East Bay. I had to drive an hour into the city to do this open mic after a full day of work. I was the first one there. I was wearing like a suit jacket. Like I was dressed like, you know, what I thought a stand-up comedian dressed like and what I had seen everyone on TV dress like. And got there at 6 o'clock. The open mic didn't start till 8, but you could sign up at 6. So I was the first person to sign up, but I knew I didn't want to go first. So I signed up number 3, you know, so I thought the host will go, the couple more, and then I'll go, you know, and the audience will be good by then. But because I was the new guy, they kept bumping me down. The guy who was hosting kept bumping me down. So I was there at 6. I didn't go on till 11 at night and the place was closing down and I had to work the next day. I ended up, so even though I signed up 3rd, I think I ended up going like 34th or something that night. Everyone got 5 minutes. They kept bumping me. So by the time I went on, and at one point the crowd was hot and there were people all over the place. By the time I got on, the only people left were some lady folding her laundry, the last comic who had gone on, the host who kept bumping me, and then a guy who was cleaning tables. So no one. And it was terrible. And I think in my 5 minutes, I got one chuckle from the guy who was cleaning the tables. But it was still enough. I was still like, it still bit me like, you know, like an addiction. I was like, oh, you know, that I was like, this sucks. This someone laughed, you know, like it bummed me. And as I don't know if you're a big, well, we're talking about movies later. As I left, I was walking back. So now it's almost midnight by this time as I'm getting back to my car and I have to drive back an hour to my apartment. And I got to get up in 6 hours to go to work. So all that ahead of me, and I just had this awful experience at a laundromat, but even still, just that one laugh, and because I had started this thing I had dreamt about for 2 decades almost, as I walked to my car, I remember giving like a John Bender from Breakfast Club punch in the air, like, yes, I did it, you know, like I did it. And I was convinced in my own mind, like, I'm probably 6 months away from doing the Tonight Show, you know what I mean? Like, this is the beginning. Sure, it sucked tonight, but it's only going to get better. But yeah, it was terrible. But again, I didn't know any different at that time. So luckily, I do think it. You have to probably comics, and I have talked about this. Like it's, you know, some people always say I went up the first time and I killed, and I don't know that that really happens ever. I think people might think they do, and it's again, your brain plays a trick on you, so maybe that's good. But I think you have to do okay, at least, in your first five times. If you didn't in your... It's so awful when you're not doing well. If you didn't do well by the fifth time in, then you might give up. But usually, there's enough, just like that. Like, one, at least one laugh is enough that you're like, okay, maybe I got something here.
But that says a lot about how far you've come. Because from that start on a laundromat with just three, four people there to where you're at now, right?
Yeah. So from that to... It took 2 years... So let's see, so I was 99, 3 years later, 2.5 to 3 years later, I quit my day job and I was doing stand-up comedy full-time and haven't done another job since. You know, that's not comedy related. I've written for shows and stuff like that, but all out of comedy.
I know.
So you mentioned Pryor, but other than him, did you have another favorite stand-up comedian growing up? Someone that inspired you or that you tried to emulate?
I mean, geez, it changes almost every month or year or even day sometimes where you see someone and they inspire you. So, you know, my list has gone on and on. Obviously, Pryor was the first one. Letterman, I never really got to see a lot of Letterman's stand-up, but his sense of humor really influenced me, just his dry sense of humor. He was a Midwest guy. He wasn't particularly good-looking, you know. He was kind of weird-looking, so that kind of made me... think, oh, I could do this, you know. It's so funny because like Pryor, like I was a white kid from the Midwest. My comedy is nothing like Richard Pryor's, but he was an influence in some ways. You know, the same way Sam Kinison. I loved Sam Kinison, but I don't yell and scream on stage or I'm not as edgy as him. Brian Regan now is you know, maybe from when I got into comedy or, you know, started doing it professionally, probably like before that open mic story, I was listening to a lot of Brian Regan. So he was one of those guys. He's a very clean comedian. If you ask 100 comedians who their favorite comedian is, half of them probably say Brian Regan.
I love him.
Yeah, he's just fantastic. And so he's probably like in the closest to what I do in my comedy. So he's a big influence. But again, all those guys, Woody Allen, but, you know, Bill Hicks, Bob Newhart, all of my it's one of those like. You know, they've all influenced me in some little way. Even and so many people in San Francisco, the guys who were the big comics in San Francisco. This guy Arj Barker was I was a huge fan of him, and he's kind of blown up. He's huge in Australia. He's on a lot of TV shows and stuff now. It's just endless, the number of influences. Yeah.
What about the new guys, the ones that are just coming out? Anyone that you look forward to, you like in particular?
Well, yeah. And I mean, again, there's so many here in LA. You get to see so many. Like, it's one of the problems is, you know, you stop going. I get to do so many shows now. I can work out new material on a show that I'm doing versus having to go to the open mic. So I don't get to see as many of the super new people. So this is going to sound crazy because he's not new at all. But he's again, 10 years into my comedy career is when I discovered him. Like John Mulaney. I love John Mulaney. He's not new at all, again, but he's one of those guys. To me, he seems newer than me. So, like, it seems, you know, there's Regan was before me, there's me, and then, like, after that. Not to put myself in position with those, but I'm just saying, like, Regan seems older because he was doing it before me. Mulaney seems younger because he started after me, that kind of thing. Like, obviously, this guy, Steve Simone, he's probably my favorite, like, and it's unfair to say unknown, because he's almost like Brian Regan. The people that know him and love him, and he's got a cult following. He's probably my, of the guys, again, younger, my favorite right now. If you're looking for someone you haven't experienced yet and a different kind of humor, he's got it. He's super funny.
One of your most notable experiences was your battle with cancer and your journey to perform on David Letterman's show. So how did that came to be?
As I mentioned, the Pryor and Letterman together about that time, but between 10 and 12, really formed me as far as like wanting to get into stand-up comedy. And so, you know, one of my dreams was to one day perform. So I got to see all the comics that would come on Letterman, from Kinison to Andy Kaufman to Jake Johansson and Brian Regan. Johansson and Regan both did Letterman like 30 or 40 times each. It's an incredible number. So that became my dream. Like, that's what I would tell myself those years in high school and in the Navy and even in college afterwards. Like, someday I'm going to perform on the David Letterman show. So as I mentioned, I got into comedy, and after a couple of years, I was making a living at it. And just the way I had worked was be good at something. You know, this is kind of the Midwest work ethic. Get good at something, and then people will hear that you're good at it, and that'll open doors. And that's sure enough what was happening. That's how I made my way and was able to leave my day job, because all of a sudden, people that in San Francisco who were seeing me were like, oh, you should contact this club. You should contact this. People were hearing about me and reaching out, and that was enough, just making a name for myself, I guess. But I hadn't really been chasing that original dream of, hey, I want to get on the David Letterman show. I just figured, just keep going forward and it'll eventually, you know, happen. That's kind of how I was thinking about it, because good things were happening that way already. But then in 2005, about, you know, 6 years into my comedy career and, you know, four or five doing it full time at that point, I was coming home from a comedy club, the Improv out in Ontario here in California. And had a pain in my side and thought it was maybe food poisoning, because food at a comedy club is never good. That's my wife. She was my girlfriend then. When I got home, was like, yeah, I think you got food poisoning. But eventually she took me to the emergency room, and they're like, oh, we think your appendix burst. So we're going to remove your appendix. When I woke up from that surgery, it was a different doctor there, and he introduced himself as an oncologist, which I knew was a bad sign. And he said, hey, your appendix was fine, but we still removed it. They called me in because they found tumors all over your liver. We're going to run biopsies on them. And as that unfurled over the next few weeks, the biopsies and searching for stuff, it turned out I had stage 4 cancer at that point. It was cancer they had found in my intestines, but it spread to my liver. And the worst case scenario at that point was that I might only have 5 years to live. It was a very rare type of cancer. Now we're talking, we're 15 years later, 16 years later, 2021 now. I'm here, I'm healthy. But at that point, I had to believe what they're saying, that hey, I'm not a worst case scenario guy. But when doctors, you know, it was a panel of doctors at that point at UCLA saying, we don't know a lot about this cancer from what we know and seeing other people. You may only have 5 years to live. That's the worst case scenario. You know, I had to take that pretty seriously and be like, okay, I'm going to beat this. That was my attitude. But also, if you really only have 5 years, what do you want to cram in there? So one of the things, I ended up marrying the girlfriend, and I renewed that goal of getting on the David Letterman show. So I decided to dedicate that 5 years to getting on the David Letterman show. In fact, at the beginning, I gave myself a year to get on the David Letterman show. But that was naive. That was a ridiculous, like the ignorance of thinking I was going to be on the Tonight Show 6 months after that Laundromat show. It's just not possible to make things happen that quick. So I started, this is before, this sounds strange to say now, to say, like, we were talking about cable, imagining a time before cable. But 2005 is before Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, I think, was just starting at that point. So what I did, I had a project. I started a project called, ironically, Dying to Do Letterman. And it was my goal thing to just force myself to do everything I could, to pull out every stop to do it. So I would do shows. And if people came up afterwards and said, oh my God, you're hilarious, we love you, I would say, hey, all right, if you really love me, I'm trying to get on the David Letterman show. Here's where you can email the show for me if you really think I'm that good. I want to get their attention. So that was my goal, to kind of get the attention of the East Coast. They're a little East Coast, West Coast centric, the talk show. So they were located in New York. And so as a West Coast guy, it was hard to get their attention. So that was my initial goal. And I gave myself a year to do it, and it didn't happen in a year or 2 years or 3 years. And during that time, they got fed up with me and sent me a cease and desist letter. I think they didn't know anything about me. I think they were thinking it was just like a make-a-wish thing. Like, oh, this guy has cancer and wants to be on Letterman. Like, they didn't know that I was a comedian and I was making a living at it. And I was, you know, quality enough to be it. So the whole process was getting their attention and chasing it. But that was the whole goal, was, you know, making that happen within those 5 years or whatever time I had left, chasing my dream since I had just been waiting for it to come to me. So it was kind of turning that whole thing on its head. And I had a web. So because there was no Facebook or Twitter, all these things you might do now, it was just, I had a website where that people, it was called Dying to Do Letterman. And there was a link, and it was like, here's my comedy. You can see videos of my comedy. And here's a link to Dave. If you think I'm good enough, drop him a line. So that was the project. And it ended up not happening in first year, second year, third year, fourth year. It took almost the entire 5 years of that worst case scenario. I finally got a call after dozens of DVDs, and they finally, after 3 years, started taking me seriously and were like, okay, send us some stuff. And then it was just finding the right stuff. I had convinced the booker pretty quickly that I was a comedian. He was like, okay, you're good. This isn't just a make-a-wish thing, but now it's... You have to have the right type of humor. You think you're good enough for Letterman, but we don't think they're good enough for Letterman. So then it was just a process of finding the right bit. And when I finally made it happen, it was a bit, it was like a toss away, like a joke I didn't think they would like at all, because it wasn't anything like anything I had seen on their show before.
Was that the hotel one?
Yeah. So it's a joke about hotel keys. And, you know, usually if you see, again, because I'm a comedy fan first, so I watch lots of late night comedy, and I watch lots of Letterman comedy. So if you see a comedian, they usually do 5 to 6 minutes. And so in there, there's probably 10 jokes, you know what I mean? One topic every 30 seconds or so like that. This joke I had sent him, and in fact, I didn't mean to send him this joke. I just got lazy. The booker was rejecting everything I sent him. So he was like, no, he would like one thing. He'd be like, I like this, but not this and this and this and this. Those are all bad. But I do like this. Dave would love this. I remember the very first time he's like, Dave would love this joke. It was a joke I have about fractions. It was like where a car insurance company says they can insure you for a fraction of what you're paying. Unfortunately, that fraction was 5/3. I remember him being like, Dave, that's a hilarious joke, and Dave would love that. I could see him laughing. So then of course, I was trying to write jokes like that. Like, I was trying to replicate that and come up with 5 minutes of jokes like that, but it was chasing this weird thing. I wasn't being myself anymore. I was chasing what I thought they wanted. So I would send him these DVDs with 5 minutes of stuff, and he would say, no, 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 no. One time I had a 10-minute DVD, and I just got lazy and didn't edit out the last 5 minutes because it was one long joke. It was one topic, and I knew they didn't book stuff like that. But I got lazy and didn't edit it out. I just sent him the DVD. And again, this is the other thing. We weren't sending links to YouTube stuff at this point. It was physical DVDs. And he got back to me, and he's like, hey, I hated the first 5 minutes, but... this hotel key bit you have at the end is great. I love this. And so it just shows you how stupid, like, you chase. I was chasing one thing, and the thing I thought he wouldn't like is what he ended up liking. You just never know.
That's great. That was how many years after the laundromat?
So that was, yeah, almost after the laundromat, it was 10 years, a decade. Yeah.
Okay. You made it. And you've been more than once?
No, it was funny because I was so concentrated on that first one. I remember getting home afterwards, and like a week later, you know, I'm still on a high for it. I got a nice card from one of the producers, the executive producer, and he's like, one of the great debuts on Letterman. Thank you so much. Can't wait to see you again soon. Like, and I was like, oh my God, I hadn't even thought. Of course I want to be back on the show. Like, you know, it was so stupid in my mind. And I had been on other TV shows like along the way that, you know, I had done more than once, but it just had never occurred to me that I would do Letterman more than once. And then before I was able to make that happen, he ended up retiring. So just the once on Letterman, though.
I'm glad you're healthy. You're healthy now, like you said. So that's great. You're a writer. You said you won an Emmy for your work on Ellen DeGeneres' show, right?
Yeah. A year after Letterman, I got the opportunity to write for her daytime show.
How do you approach comedy writing? I mean, you just talk a bit about the process more oriented to stand-up comedy, but how do you approach comedy writing for a show like that or for other TV shows? I mean, like all genres and all things, comedy has gone through a lot of changes, a lot of evolution from the slapstick of the early 20th century to the satires of the 70s or the raunchy comedies of the 80s and 90s. How do you get in tune with things that you know can make people laugh now and might be timeless as well?
There's so many, and I don't know that I have the exact answer. I can only tell you what I try and do. I found it pretty easy to write for Ellen because, one, we have similar senses of humor. We're both very observational comedians, both very clean. I found it easier to write for her than myself because it's almost like it's easier to see someone else from the outside. I can look at Ellen and I know, we all know what her humor is. You can be like, oh, that's an Ellen. That's so Ellen. Like, you know. So, you know, I before I started the job, I read all of her books and watched all of her specials again. So I could kind of get in that vein of things. So it's pretty easy to write for her. I mean, it was just tough, like what's going to work in the confines of her talk show or a monologue that week and keeping it all one topic. So I found that easier to write for her than myself almost because it's hard to be objective about yourself. You know what I mean? Like you're everything subjective. Even today, when people are like, "Oh, what do you joke? What are your what kind of comic are you? What do you do?" I'm like, I don't know. Like I touch on all those things that you just mentioned. Sometimes I'll do some physical comedy. Sometimes I'll have some satire. You know, a bit that's obviously satire. Some that's a metaphor for something else bigger and smart. And some that's just the stupidest, silliest thing you've ever seen. Where some, you know. But that ends up being the jokes, you know, that I love, that are so sophomoric and stupid but you just can't help laughing at. You know, it's one step above a fart joke almost, but it's still one of those that you get a gut wrench from the audience that they're like, I don't want to laugh at that, but that's so stupid, it's funny.
Yeah, I know.
So I have my hands like in all those when I'm writing. That's what I mean. It's almost easier to write for someone else because I can see what their brand is more than my own brand. So
that's great. You host a podcast, like you mentioned before, the Mason Movie Club.
Yep.
Where you and your guests talk about certain films, acclaimed films. How and why did you start this?
It's called the Mason Movie Club. And my idea was, I love movies. And I end up talking about movies. Like, again, if you and I were just hanging out right now, something would come up or we'd be talking and I'd be like, oh, that reminds me of the scene in whatchamacallit, blah, blah, blah. Everything gets taken back to movies for me. Like, again, I grew up loving movies. My mom introduced me. We would spend a lot of time going to the movie theaters together. She's a big movie lover. You know, love reading about movies. I grew up in Chicago, so Siskel and Ebert were big even, but, you know, around that age that I'm talking about, them, like, really making an art form out of movie reviews and stuff like that and taking it seriously as an art form. So I just loved it. And like I said, I end up talking probably half the day anyways, whether there's a microphone in front of me or not, about movies. You know, whoever I'm talking to conversationally, I love other people that love movies. And like I said, I end up taking everything back. Everything reminds me of a scene in a movie. I can always take it back to that. So when it came time to like, okay, maybe I'll do a podcast, movies just became obvious as the choice, because I was like, all right, I'm talking about this stuff anyways, I might as well start recording some of it. And again, I always liked the idea of a book club, you know, where a group of people come together and they all read the same thing and then you talk about it. That's fun. I love that idea, but I don't like reading as much as I like watching. So it's really a book club for people who hate to read is the idea behind it. And so, yeah, that was the impetus. And then just to use, kind of have a structure at the beginning, I feel like, okay, what are we going to watch? And I figured everyone's doing podcasts on like the movie that's coming out this week. And then you got to, if it's a movie that's coming out this week, like let's say, you know, the Tom Hanks movie that came out a couple weeks ago, News of the World, right? Well, if I do a podcast on it, do I have to worry about spoiler alerts? Do I have to, like, are people going to listen before they see it or after they see it? So my idea was to do movies we've all seen, but you want to revisit. You want to rewatch them. So I counted down originally the top 100 movies on IMDb and then the top 100 movies as rated by the American Film Institute. There's some crossover between those two. And right now, since people are unemployed and the pandemic and at home and that kind of thing, and don't have as much money to like rent these movies and that kind of thing each week, for the movie club, we've just been doing movies that are free on Amazon or Netflix, because most people have those things. So great movies that are great. So and then, ironically, this week, the movie is the Richard Pryor concert that I watched originally that got me in, called Richard Pryor Live in Concert. It's free on Netflix. So if anyone hasn't seen it, they should watch it. It's a great, it's elevated above just a comedy special. It's again, it's the greatest stand-up comedy ever put on film. And it's one of those, even if after you watch it, you're like, yeah, it doesn't seem much different than what Chris Rock and Chappelle and Bill Burr are doing today. It's like, yeah, but this was done 40 years ago. You know what I mean? Like everything was influenced by this. Like, I don't know if you're a I would assume, Carlo, are you a big music guy?
Yeah, I like music.
People always ask me, they're like, you like in my day, like growing up, they were a little before me, but like Led Zeppelin was I had a lot of friends that are, and I just never got into Led Zeppelin. Like if they come on the radio, sure, I'll listen to it, but I would never go out and buy an album. But when I talk to music people, they're like, oh, no, what you're missing is their influence on everyone, that all the bands that I do like, that I would buy their album, they're like, they were influenced by Led Zeppelin, you know, so it's that influence, and that's how Richard Pryor is, and this specifically, this movie and this stand-up in it again, up to this point, people were just doing, like, jokes. You know, silly things that, like, we were talking about, like farts. And this guy's actually up there talking about his real life, about suicide and depression and addiction. And people hadn't done that up until he came along. So, it's really impressive. And it's on Netflix, so people should watch it.
Yeah, I need to see it. I haven't
seen
it. Yeah,
100%. I'm excited for you that you haven't seen it.
I'll let you know how it goes.
Yes, I think you'll love it.
One of the main reasons why I wanted to invite you and talk with you, and I think I mentioned this to you a few times, is that your podcast was one of the first podcasts I got into a few years ago. I think it was 2017, 2018, I don't know. I don't think I had listened to any podcast before, but when I decided to get into it, obviously I like films, so I think I Googled film podcast or something like that, and yours came up, and I've listened to a lot of episodes since then, and I love it. So fast forward to 2020. And I was starting my own podcast, and you were definitely an influence. So I thought, you know, I have to get Steve Mazin here and talk about movies with him. So thank you.
Well, listen, Carlo, I can't tell you what that means to me. And I'm sure you're finding it already on your podcast. Like, the thing I love about stand-up is it's the most immediate art form. Like, you're in front of an audience, you say something, and they let you know immediately either they love it or nothing. You know what I mean? You'll know that wasn't good. Podcast, you know, not that we, I don't know if it's an art form yet or whatever, but it's a new thing. It's literally, what are we, maybe 20 years old podcasting? It's not as immediate. You put it out there and you hope people enjoy it. So to hear someone say, anyone, I love when people write me and say, oh my God, I love this week's episode. Even that makes me, so that it inspired you to make your own podcast. I can't tell you how great that makes me feel. Thank you.
You're welcome. And one of the things I enjoy more of your podcast, other than the obvious discussion, is that you have an ability to bring guests that are not only engaging, but they are really knowledgeable. There are lots of people that were guests at the many episodes I listened to that I ended up following on social media
because I thought,
you know, I have to listen more of this guy or read more of this guy. Some examples, Jeff Canada, who also has a podcast right now, Slash Film Podcast.
Yep.
Rick Ramos.
Rick Ramos was another one that
left an impression.
Yeah, fantastic. Cash Levy.
They were all really, really great guests that I thought, you know, these guys know their stuff. They're really good guests. So all of those and many more, they really left an impression.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Well, I'm going to pass word on to them too. Because again, they're the same way. And guys that Rick and Cash, you know, they're not only guests, but like friends. And they're people that I'd be talking to anyways about this. So it's great to have a recording. And then for other people to find them, that makes me feel so good. Because, you the same way I'm saying, like, I'm excited for you to see Richard Pryor since you haven't seen that special.
Yeah.
Or I mentioned Steve Simone earlier as my favorite, like, young comedian. I'm excited when people discover something that I was able to introduce them to. So that's great. That makes me feel really good.
So let's play a game. You want to play a game?
Let's play it. I would love to.
Okay. The game is called What's the Punchline?
Okay.
Just like the title says, I'm going to read several quotes from popular comedy films. I'm going to polish my acting skills here.
Okay.
and you have to finish the joke or the punchline. What do you say?
All right. Let's do it.
Okay. Surely you can be serious. Punchline.
The punchline is, yes. I don't know if I'll nail it exactly, but it's, yes, I can. Yes, I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Yes, that's right. You got it.
I might have off by a word.
No, that's
Airplane.
Okay.
One of my favorites. We've done that for the movie club too. We have, like, over the pandemic, it was free on Netflix, so we watch it. It's so good.
Yeah, it's a great comedy.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Gentlemen, you can fight in here. Punchline?
You can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Yes. That's from Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove, yes. Or How I Learned Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, the big, huge parenthetical title.
Everything was fine with our system until the power grid was shut off by Dickless here. They caused an explosion. Is this true? Punchline?
Yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
Yes.
Did I deliver it right?
You got it right. That's
Bill Murray,
Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters. So one of the best. That's one of those where it's like movies. That's what I love about movies and why I talk about them. Because when you really love something, you can remember like what theater you saw the movie at and that kind of stuff. Like, you go deep in it. I don't remember what movie I saw Ghostbusters in, but I remember loving the movie. And then that line came out, and it's like, that's one of the greatest lines ever. Like, it was already a fantastic movie. And when he says, it's true, this man has no dick, and his great Bill Murray delivery. It's so good.
Yeah. Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left. Yes, I have. Look. Punchline?
It's a flesh wound?
Yes.
It's just a flesh wound?
You got it. Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
let's see a newer one. Let's see if you got this one.
Okay.
This is one of my favorites. Without further ado, I give you the Derek Zoolander Center for Kids Who Can't Read Good. Punchline?
I know it's Zoolander. I don't know the punchline, though.
Oh, no, you have to see that one. The bad guy is showing him like a model, a small model of a school he's going to build for the guy. And Zoolander is so dumb that he looks at the model and says, "What is this? A center for ants?" It's one of my favorite comedies recent. I didn't put it on my list, but it's great. Okay, another one. Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder? Punchline?
I can't remember how he says it, but it's basically something like, no, but this is 11. This goes to 11.
This is Spinal Tap. Yeah, that's another one that's great.
I mean, it's one of the greats of all time. Just so stupid. That's what I mean about it. It's so stupid. It's how do you explain that to someone? Like, if they're like, why is it funny? It's like, you can't explain it. It just is funny.
Yeah. Just a couple more. What do you expect? Welcome, Sonny. Make yourself at home. Marry my daughter. You got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are the people of the land, the common clay of the New West. Punchline?
I don't know. I don't know this one. This one I don't recognize. Is this Kingpin? What is this?
No, this is Blazing Saddles.
Oh, shit.
At the end, he says, the common clay of the New West. You know, morons.
Morons, yeah.
Just another one, the last one. To call you stupid would be an insult to stupid people. I've known sheep that could outwit you. I've worn dresses with higher IQs. But you think you're an intellectual, don't you, ape? Apes don't read philosophy. Punchline?
Gosh, I'm recognizing the words, but I can't picture the movie. I don't know.
A Fish Called Wanda. He says, "Yes, they do, Otto. They just don't understand it."
Oh my God! Yeah, Kevin Kline and more Monty Python alumni. But yeah.
Yeah, Kevin Kline and Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes.
That's great. You did good.
Yeah, I did better than I thought.
That's great. I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. Thank you. Keep my mind.
So let's talk about our picks, our comedy loot, so to speak.
Oh yeah, I'm excited to hear, yeah, and see if any of the movies we mentioned from the game, did they come up on your list?
No.
Okay.
No, not really. Let's see the ones that we consider our favorite comedies. So let's start with you. You're number 5.
Okay. Ooh, let me look here. I had like a list of, I was like, all right, I'll come up with 5. And then my list kept growing. I was like, And so it came to like 15. And then I narrowed it to 5, and I forgot to put them in order. So let me see here. I can do it, though, on the fly. All right, so this is my 5th, so we'll count down to 1.
Yeah.
Number 5, The Graduate.
Oh, that's great.
Dustin Hoffman, and again, not a... I put it on the list. It made the top 5 because it's a different kind of comedy. It's kind of a dry comedy. It's a little, you know, thinking it's not... It's very subtle, subversive, and it's definitely got some laugh-out-loud moments, but it doesn't have... It's one of those... It's hard to create some of the great lines in there. Like, you wouldn't pull a funny line from The Graduate, but it is super funny.
I had the plastics line in the game, but I eventually ended up pulling it out.
Oh, good. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's, that would be the line.
That's a good choice. I saw The Graduate for the first time, I think, last year. I hadn't seen it before. And I was surprised by how I was expecting more comedy.
Yeah.
But it's very heavy. It's a very heavy film in terms of relationships and how this couple handles the relationship. It's pretty good. I love it.
Yeah. And that's why I ended up putting it in my top 5. I was like, because it's not your typical comedy. Comes from a different way. And I got to tell you, I saw it probably when I was around this time we were talking about when I started getting into stand-up. So I probably saw it when I was 10. And then of course, I saw it in my 20s. And then we watched it just this past year for the movie club. And it was a different experience at each of those levels, at being a 10-year-old in my 20s. And then, now older, like I experienced it differently. And that's, I think, a sign of a great film is it works from all three directions. When I was a kid, I thought it was, you know, there was some silliness to it, which there is. In my 20s, I thought it was against older people. And now I think they're making fun of youth culture just as much in the movie. Like, it's what's great about it. When you find a great movie, it works on a few different levels.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
What do you got for number five?
My number five, I started with a silly one, but it's a one that I hold dear to my heart. And it's 1989's UA Chef from Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The drink from the fire hose.
Yeah, you got it. It's a film I've seen. I saw a long time ago, and it became one of our favorite films with my best friends and a source of endless quotes from it. It's so stupid. Like you said earlier, the jokes are so silly, so stupid that you can't help but laugh at them. I really love it. My friends and I wouldn't stop quoting the, what was his name? Raul, the man with the animals.
Who's throwing the
dogs out of the window. Or the competition of Wheel of Fish. It's a hilarious comedy, really.
It's so funny. That's a great one.
So you're number four.
Number four. Ooh. It's tough to, it is hard to put them in order too. The Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers, and again, it's a different kind of comedy because it's a musical almost, but it's not a musical in the traditional sense. And I was a huge Saturday Night Live guy, and it's really the first movie from Saturday Night Live that became a movie where the characters from it, John Belushi at his best, Dan Aykroyd at his best, and fantastic movie, and endlessly quotable, you know, all the stuff in there. John Candy making an appearance, Orange Whip, you know, endlessly quotable, which all the great comedies are. Yeah, Blues Brothers, fantastic.
That's one that I don't know if I've seen it. I saw it, it was probably when I was a kid because one of my older brothers is a fan. But I really don't remember. If I saw it, I don't remember. But I need to get to it.
Yeah, another one. And again, great to revisit. Even if you had seen it before, coming back to it, more to like.
So my number four is Clerks from Kevin Smith.
Oh, love it, love it. That's a great one. Yes.
Clerks is special because you see the budget, but the film is helped by that budget. You know, you see this interaction between all these people, and it's so natural and so funny. I mean, this character, the guy that plays Randall, he's so funny,
and
it's weird that you don't see that guy doing anything
else.
How
is he not? He is so good. They're both so good, but yeah.
It's one of, like you said, endlessly quotable, another film that you can mention 100 quotes out of it and you can get a laugh off.
There's a great book called Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes. And it's about Spike Lee. The Slackers part is Richard Linklater and then Kevin Smith in there too. And it's a bit, you know, about the independent film market. And this is, what was Clerks? Early 90s? Late 80s?
1994.
Okay. So that kind of feel then, and again, where technology has come in those 25 years, people, again, Kevin Smith made this, you know, at a convenience store on his own. Like, it's guerrilla independent filmmaking at its best, and to make it, it is one of the best comedies. It's amazing. So anyone out there, again, I always say when we talk about it on the podcast, like, if you're like, oh, I have an idea, but how would I get it made? You have no excuse now. You have an excuse. Literally, you have this. You have a, I'm holding up my phone to you. You have a phone now. This is better technology than Kevin Smith had in 1994. It's no excuse. It's fantastic. It's a great one.
So you're number three.
Okay, number three. It's going to be hard to pick which one gets to the top. Talladega Nights. This is a tough one because I love Anchorman as well, but Talladega Nights just a little bit extra for me. Again, endlessly quotable, endlessly rewatchable. If I sit down at any part of it, I end up watching the rest of the movie. If I turn on the TV and it happens to be on, I'll end up watching the whole thing. The kids are hilarious. The dinner scene. I remember when this came out, I remember like flipping around. I was in a hotel for comedy and they had Fox News on, and Fox News was running a piece. They're like, is the movie Talladega Nights making fun of people in the South? And it's like, yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. Yes. And they're like, they were trying to do like a serious thing. They're making fun of like us and our people. It's like, yeah, that's the point. Like, yeah, you're old Jesus. And I love baby Jesus. It's so funny. John C. Reilly, endlessly quotable. It's fantastic.
That's another one I haven't seen.
Oh, jeez, I'm so excited for you.
I don't know if it's because I'm not that into races. I know, you know, that's a Midwest thing, but I don't know if I'm gonna get as much of it as other people.
Oh, 100% you will. This is like it's like saying Zoolander. You're not into male modeling, but you still love Zoolander.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? Like it's the racing is secondary. It's just an excuse for all these jokes. It's really great. You'll love it.
I'm gonna have to add a couple to my watch list.
Yes.
So my number three is Spaceballs from Mel Brooks.
Oh, love it, love it. Yeah.
A great, great combination of sci-fi and comedy, a perfect mocking of the space genre, Star Wars and whatnot. I love it. And it has probably what might be one of my favorite comedy scenes. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it 100 times, probably.
The scene when Dark Helmet puts the tape, the Spaceballs tape, and they start like going and seeing the tape.
And they rewind.
This is now. No,
no, that was it.
One of the best comedy bits I've seen. I love it. I love that scene. I love the film.
I love it too because people always think right away, they think Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein from Mel Brooks. Spaceballs died when it came out. It didn't do well at the box office. People were saying he was done. And then it's just grown over the years, the appreciation. And I think, you know, the appreciation for Star Wars, that continued growing. People revisit Spaceballs. It's got what I think is one of my favorite lines of all time. Comedy lines, and I think it's the most repeated line in other movies, and the other movies don't even know they're getting it from Spaceballs, and I'm going to reenact it here for you. It's, I can't remember his name. Is John Candy's name Barth? Is it Barth?
Yes.
And he's sitting in the thing, and he goes to get up, but he leaves his seatbelt on, and he goes, oh! And then he goes, he takes it off, and he goes, that's going to leave a mark. And it's just a throwaway line. But when you watch movies now, watch. That line comes up in so many movies, and I'm convinced it started there with John Candy and Spaceballs. That's going to leave a mark. The people say that comedians say it all the time. That's going to leave a mark. It started there. It's a fantastic. So funny.
Yeah, it's a great film. What are your number two?
Oh, okay, this is tough between two and one. I'm going to go a little offbeat, so we'll go classical for number one. Raising Arizona for number two. Nicolas Cage at his best. Nicolas Cage, every time he acts, swings for the fences, and half the time he pops up or foul balls and he's out, but every once in a while he connects, and it's a home run, and this is one of his home runs. He's fantastic. Holly Hunter's fantastic. It's the Coen brothers before they really had this myth of the Coen brothers and what they were, and it's not as polished as Fargo or that kind of stuff, but it's, I don't even have kids. But it's, you know, this all this allegory of about parenthood and stuff and the worry you have about having kids. And it's so funny and so many quotes. It's got one of my favorite comedy lines of all time. It takes place at the checkout counter. John Goodman's in it. The guy says he pulls some balloons from the thing and he asks the checkout clerk, hey, are these balloons make those funny shapes? And the lady goes, not unless you think round is funny. it's just so stupid, but perfectly delivered. It's fantastic. So yeah, Raising Arizona.
Yeah, that it's a great one. I saw it last year or the year before for the first time.
Yeah,
a couple of months after my wife and I adopted two kids. So it hit home really, really well. I saw myself in Nicolas Cage character. So I loved it, really. So my number two is one that I really, really hold dear to my heart, too, is Liar Liar from Jim Carrey.
Yeah, that's one of my wife's favorites.
Yeah, I love that film. I think I saw it in theaters back in the day. And maybe then I would have thought, you know, my favorite Jim Carrey comedy is Dumb and Dumber because it's more crazy. But with time, this has become one of my favorite comedies.
Yeah.
Every time it's on TV, I have to see it. I love how I think this is Jim Carrey at his best physical comedy because he doesn't go that far, but he's still crazy. And the film has a lot of heart. I really love it. I might have some issues with the last act maybe, but I really love the film.
Yeah. And it's got that thing in that. It's funny you say that about the heart, because that's kind of why I picked Talladega Nights over Anchorman, and I love both of them. And Talladega Nights they're very similar and very same type of humor, but Talladega Nights has a little more heart to it, and I totally get that. I appreciate that in a movie, especially in a comedy. It's tough sometimes to be funny and have heart.
Yeah. So you're number one.
All right, number one. This one comes up on my podcast all the time. I think it might be, And this is something I value in watching all these movies is rewatchability. If you've seen it before, can you watch it again and still enjoy it? And this movie has the highest rewatchability, in my opinion. Austin Powers, the original Austin Powers, is just so good. Again, it's in the Mel Brooks spoof angle, but it does the Bond films fantastically. But at the same time, becomes their own thing. It becomes Austin Powers is equally, you know, known and imitatable as James Bond is, if not more. His lines, and people know, you know, Bond, James Bond, or Martini, you know, shaken, not stirred. Everyone knows, yeah, baby, and, you know, that kind of, they know Austin Powers, you know, would you like a shag, you know. It's super funny, super well done. The sequels are pretty good, too, but the original one, I think, is just hilarious. So, so funny and well done, which a lot of times you don't deserve in a comedy.
You know, I love it. I really love it. I had it on my short list, but eventually it left it out.
Yeah, it's tough to get it down to 5.
Yeah, I have like you said, I have like 15 too, but my number one.
All right, I'm excited.
We were talking about the Coen brothers, but my favorite comedy, it's The Big Lebowski.
Yes, so good. Yep.
That's a film that I remember seeing on video back in the 90s, and it really didn't impress me that much on first viewing, but weeks after, I found myself remembering quotes and reenacting scenes in my mind, and I thought, you know, I have to see this again. And I saw it a second time and I loved it, and I've seen it dozens of times after, and I really love it. Endlessly quotable. I love Jeff Bridges in it. Philip Seymour Hoffman is great in it. John Goodman and the Coen brothers have that talent to make fun of the absurd or stupid things in a way that feels also smart, and it's great. It's a great, great comedy.
100%, and yeah, and to the same measurement, I hold Austin Powers to endlessly rewatchable. You'll find something new. You'll enjoy the things you know, the laughs that are coming. You'll still laugh at them because the delivery and the acting is so good. And it's, yeah, I mean, some of my favorite lines from Big Lebowski. You want a toe? I'll get you a toe. Like, you know, have a toe by midnight or whatever he says. It's great. Just fantastic.
I have one of the lines in the game, but I skip it. The one that says, Smokey, this is not NAM. This is bowling. There are rules. It's so funny. Every time they shut the poor Donnie, shut the fuck up, Donnie.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie.
It's great. Those were great lists.
Yeah. It's hard to get it down to 5 because these are all deserving of the top comedies.
Yeah. So to close the podcast, I went and asked on Twitter for people to share their favorite comedies. So I'm going to read a bit so you can tell me what you think.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hear them.
My friend Alex at Art by Alex J, he said Spaceballs. But also Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Yeah, more Mel Brooks, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen Robin Hood, Men in Tights. When I told him that, he said, you have to see it.
That one's like a cult classic it's become. Because again, that one died even worse than Spaceballs at the thing. But the people who love it, love it. Like, they really love it.
Scotty at Yes, Scruffy Pirate. He said, I don't just have one. I have The Burbs, Duck Soup, A Night at the Opera, Dr. Strangelove, Coming to America, and Clue.
Oh, wow. He's got a lot of good ones.
I have a blind spot. I haven't seen a single Marx Brothers film. And this week, I've gotten a lot of Marx Brothers recommendations. I need to get on that. He shared a couple of Marx recommendations. So I need to get on that, really. Tom at Deaf Heaven, he said, my favorite comedy is The Great Race from 1965. Jack Lemmon at his absolute hammy, his lemony best, if you will. Plus, it has the greatest spy fight in the history of cinema. And it has the immortal line, rum, I never mix my pies. I don't get it. So I haven't seen it, but I will see it. Tim Dougherty at Tim_Dougherty, he said, this is Spinal Tap. Malin 181, he said, Elf. My friend at Piecing It Together podcast at Piecing Pod, he said Wet Hot American Summer, The Naked Gun, and The Nice Guys. The Nice Guys is a recent one that really, really made me laugh.
Yeah.
Leonard and Monsieur Marlowe, he said My Man Godfrey from 1936. He said it's delightful. That's with William Powell and Carol Lombard, a classic one. And finally, Ken at InterKen, he said there are a lot of worthy contenders, but in honor of the late Cloris Leachman, I'm going with Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
A movie that can make a single word funny, and that word is Ovaltine. Or possibly Butch Steps. Young Frankenstein, I haven't seen it whole, really. I need to finish it. For some reason, I started seeing it a long time ago and couldn't finish it. I don't remember why, and I've never gotten back to it. I need to finish it, really.
If you get a chance, do you like horror films? Just in general? Yeah. Are you a fan of like those, you know, the old like 1920s and 30s, like Dracula and like, oh, if some people like my wife, she, if it's black and white, she won't watch it.
No. I've seen Dracula. I've seen Frankenstein and the Wolfman. All
that was going to be my thing. I was going to say, go watch the original. If you're going to go watch Young Frankenstein again, watch the original Frankenstein first and then watch Young Frankenstein, because there's parts of it that are shot for shot, like it's, you wouldn't even get the half the joke if you don't see the original thing.
Yeah.
Like Mel Brooks is so tedious in recreating stuff. It's amazing. It's really impressive what he was doing there.
So Steve, that's it. Tell me, what are you working right now?
Yeah, just not working because of comedy and cruise ships and comedy clubs and corporations are all shut down. So I can't do much comedy right now. Pretty much putting all my attention into the podcast and some virtual shows, though, too. But yeah, if people are interested, they can find me. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Steve Mazan, M-A-Z-A-N. And yeah, the podcast is, I forgot the name of my podcast, Mazan Movie Club, M-A-Z-A-N, Mazan Movie Club. Oh, and by the way, I didn't even mention it. Since we're talking about movies, there's a movie. I talked about my Letterman stuff, trying to get on Letterman and stuff. There was a couple filmmakers followed me on that journey and made a film called Dying to Do Letterman, which won awards at comedy festival, or not comedy festival, film festivals across the country. Besides me, it's got a lot of famous comedians in it. I interview them about their journey to get on Letterman. And I didn't make the film. It's about my journey, but I didn't make it. The filmmakers are very talented. And so I recommend it highly. If you're looking to be inspired, it's the beginning of the year. Watch this movie. They do a great job of telling the story. Like we've all read a book and then they make a movie and the movie's terrible. That's what I'm saying. They told the story so well that I enjoy seeing when I see it, because it doesn't even feel like I'm watching me. They're just incredible storytellers, and people have really been inspired by it. So it's on Amazon. You can watch it. It's called Dying to Do Letterman. I guarantee you'll like it.
Yes, I'll check it out. Is there someone you dream of working with? Someone you wish you could work with?
You know, my friend, I have a friend who does some work with Conan, and I love Conan now. I mean, I would love to, obviously, Letterman's doing more shows, so I would love to do something with him. He's the Coen brothers, obviously. I love all their movies, like, in different ways. I love how different each of them are, that they can do serious stuff and the comedies that we've mentioned today. So, yeah, them, obviously. So, yeah, I think that. The Coen brothers, Conan, yeah, and Letterman, if he's still going to stick around a little longer.
So where can people find you on the internet?
Yes, so stevemazon.com is my website. And then if you just put Steve Mazon Instagram, Steve Mazon Facebook, Steve Mazon Twitter, I'll pop up on all those. And, yeah, it's M-A-Z-A-N. Yep, and then the podcast. Again, if you like the idea of a book club but don't like to read, I do the same thing just like you. I share a lot of my listeners' viewpoints on the movies. That's the part of it. That's the book club part of it, that we all discuss it together. So yeah, find that Mazan Movie Club on iTunes and wherever else.
Steve, it's been an honor having you here. I want to wish you the best in your career and in your life. Hope we can do it again.
Yeah, thanks, Carlo. I hope you'll come on my podcast. I return the favor. And yeah, thanks so much for the kind words. Like I said, to hear that this helped you jump into it yourself, that makes me feel great.
Yeah, I'll be honored. Say hello to Denise and the Irish critic.
Deal. I will. I'll let them know you said hello.
Take care, Steve.
Okay. Thanks, Carlo.
Well, that was it for the Comedy Loot, the third episode of the year of Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. Once again, I want to thank Steve Mazan for his time. Remember to check out his stuff on social media, as well as his podcast, The Mazan Movie Club. As for me, you know you can find me on Twitter at ThiefCGT and the podcast at TMML2021. You can also follow me on Instagram and Letterboxd. Remember also to share the podcast so more people can join us in the loot. Finally, stay tuned for our next episode, the February Loot, where I'll cover the loot of films I'm seeing during the month, and our first episode of March, where we will have another great guest. Stay tuned for that. Thank you all for listening, and keep looting.
And so, Theodore Donald Karavatsos, in accordance with what we think your dying wishes might well have been, we commit your final mortal remains to the bosom of the Pacific Ocean, which you love so well. Good night, sweet prince. Oh shit, dude, I'm sorry. Goddamn wind. Fuck.
God damn it, Walter. You fucking asshole.
Dude, I'm sorry.
What's the fucking travesty with you, man?
Dude, I'm sorry, it was an accident.
What was that shit about Vietnam?
Dude, I'm sorry.
What the fuck? Does anything have to do with Vietnam?
Dude, I'm
what
sorry.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Dude, I'm sorry.
Fucking. Fuck, Walter.
Come on, dude. Hey, fuck it, man. Let's go bowling.